We're here in Angel Fire. The snow has finally melted.
What'd you think about that, Nick Redfern? A little snow yesterday, last night at the hotel.
Yeah, it was kind of weird that it can be like so hot at some point in the day, then the next the temperature really goes down and you've got snow coming down.
Well, we had it all there in 35 minutes, I think. Sleet, rain.
Yeah, bit of everything.
Hail, and yeah. Evidently that was snow.
Yeah, it looked like snow.
I didn't really see that. Anyway, we're here at Angel Fire, and we're at the community center where the symposium is going on. And Nick Redfern is our guest. I guess you've probably figured that out. And he's got a new building here, which is really not new to him. He's been specializing in this for a long time, cryptozoology, but he's a monster hunter.
Well, yeah, I mean, monster hunting is, I guess, the sort of term that the press love to use.
Yeah, right.
You know, most of the things we look for aren't, by definition, monsters. They're just, a lot of them, unknown animals that science tells us doesn't exist, like the Loch Ness Monster, the Abominable Snowman. Mm-hmm. You know, that's 200, 300 years ago, the gorilla was a monster. It was a legendary monster that people would occasionally see in the forests. You know, and I think that's what the things we're looking for today are. We're just not sure what they are. So this terminology comes into play of
well,
monsters.
Well, up here in northern New Mexico, there might be some unusual creatures. Are there?
Yeah, there actually are a number of reports, particularly from around the forests of Taos and around there, of Bigfoot-type creatures. And they're very similar to those that are being reported from the Pacific Northwest. I'm aware of probably around about 9 or 10 witnesses who've talked about seeing these things in the woods around the Taos area.
When we talk about, you know, that field, there's all kinds of unusual animals and and creatures, I guess, is the best term to use.
Yeah, creatures is a good term to use.
Do you have a book out about this subject?
Yeah, I've done 4 or 5 books on cryptozoology.
I mean, recently, though.
The most recent one came out late last year. It was called There's Something in the Woods.
And what was that in the woods?
Well, actually, quite a lot. there's various chapters on Bigfoot reports around the U.S., even some strange reports like werewolf-type stories and skinwalkers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we've done shows on skinwalkers, of course, and werewolves. I'm interested in that, actually.
Well, you know, cryptozoology encompasses unknown animals, but it also encompasses what I consider more paranormal type creatures, and I think that's what werewolves are. I don't agree with the Hollywood notion of somebody changing into a werewolf.
Suddenly getting the hair and their nose gets long. And
I don't think that happens at all. I think these are paranormal or supernatural type creatures. Many sightings have been made around Native American burial mounds and grounds, and in England around stone circles, ancient stone circles like Stonehenge.
You know, these Native American burial grounds seem to have all kinds of legends and lures.
Yeah, and that's why I don't think these are physical animals, because if animals like this would be seen at any location, the fact that they're specifically viewed in places like this makes me think they're somehow connected with the location itself.
So let's flesh that out a little bit, that idea, and talk about that for a moment. So are you saying that... We're talking about werewolves, so let's pick some creature that looks sort of like a werewolf that might have started a legend. Well, would it be native to that area?
Well, yeah, I mean, what a lot of people forget or don't even realize is that if you go back into the ancient legends of werewolves from, say, the 14th and 15th centuries, they weren't viewed as being like a tall man-like figure. They just looked like normal wolves. They didn't look any different to the sort of wolf you'd see today. But the theory was that people would transform into them, but into the form of a wolf. It's only been the last couple of centuries that the image of a werewolf as walking around on two legs and looking like a hairy man with a wolf's head.
Edward de Lon Chaney came
along. Yeah, exactly. So my view is that some of the older legends could have been possibly sightings of very, very large prehistoric wolves that could have survived extinction. If you go back into the prehistoric era, there were wolves around then that were much larger than today's wolves. And I think some of these legends could be connected with sightings of those. But then again, that doesn't explain why they should be seen today around places like stone circles and areas that the Native Americans perceive of having some significance. So that's why I think there's a paranormal angle to it.
Yeah, and that kind of gets back to the skinwalker thing.
Yes, yeah. And some people have had positive experiences with these creatures. Others have felt like a negative energy almost emanating from them that's directed at them, and it's left them sort of very frightened and confused.
Yeah, you talk about some of the skinwalker legends. Mm. In modern day man, we think about they turn into some horrible beast or something. It comes out of the thin air.
Yeah.
But I guess as far as the Native American legends, actually a lot of these skinwalker type things were good.
Yeah, I think it depends on the situation, maybe even the mindset of the person as how they react to the experience. You know, if they feel the experience is going to be bad, maybe that makes the experience bad. And if they feel it's going to be positive, then positive energies come out in response.
Now, you've written 4 or 5 books, I don't remember exactly, on this subject. Yeah. You've written probably, 40 or 50 books on
it? Oh, no, about 15 or 16.
So. Oh, really? It seems like a lot. I mean, you've written about Hollywood creatures
and
other creatures.
Yeah, Hollywood celebrities.
Yeah, that's right. What got you interested in this subject?
Well, when I was about 5 years old, my parents took me on a week's holiday to Scotland, and we spent one day at Loch Ness. And even though I was sort of only 5 at the time, my dad told me this story. Yeah, I've got a few vague memories of my dad telling me this story about the Loch Ness monster, and that kind of got me interested. And then as I got older, as a teenager, I began reading books on things like Bigfoot, the Yeti, lake monsters, sea serpents, and then thought, well, you know, why don't I try and pursue it further in terms of researching about it and writing about it, which is then what I did. So.
What do you make of the Loch Ness monster itself?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of people talk about it being a plesiosaur, a surviving dinosaur. The only problem with that theory is that Loch Ness is freshwater. Plesiosaurs lived in the ocean, which is saltwater. There aren't many ocean-going animals which can successfully live in saltwater and seawater. And I think it could be or a colony of giant eels.
I started saying it had to be something more than one, I think.
Oh, yeah, there isn't a Loch Ness monster, because sightings have gone on for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Well, that's really deep water there.
Yeah, Loch Ness is about 22 miles long, a mile wide, and about 800 feet deep. And if these creatures primarily get their oxygen from the water, they probably don't have to surface that much. That's why there haven't been that many sightings and why we've never caught one. So my best guess is that they're probably giant eels, but I think the Scottish Tourist Board would love it if they were dinosaurs.
Yeah. Well, you know, the folklore and novels and everything for centuries have been full of sea monsters.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the sailors would come back from ancient times and tell stories about it. And some of it was probably based on some kind of incident.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people forget that 5/8 of the Earth's surface, I think it is, or 7/8 of the Earth's surface is covered in water. And, you know, some of the oceans are extremely deep. And we even today, we don't have the technology to descend into the really deepest parts of the ocean, certainly with people, because of the pressures, the extreme pressures that exist at that level.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be creatures living down there that we know nothing about, and that maybe occasionally divers or sailors see them. But for the most part, you know, they're elusive.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the movie I liked about the sea creature. Julie Adams, I think, was the star in the white suit, and she get. I'm trying to think of that.
I don't know what. Fathoms,
20 fathoms below, or something.
Oh, 20,000 leagues beneath the sea.
Maybe. No. I don't know.
Yeah.
So you know, this is not new, and it's certainly not new to Hollywood.
No.
But how about in real life? What's the most unusual animal you have heard about or sea creature?
Well, I would say. Just the sheer length of some of the sightings that have been reported. For example, there's a famous story from the 19th century, the 1800s, when the whole crew of a ship in the Atlantic Ocean reported seeing this creature, like a sea serpent, that they described as being about 500 feet long, which is, you know, massive. 500 feet would dwarf, you know, a school of whales, never mind just one large whale. So that's one of the sort of the strangest reports, but it's made more credible because half the crew saw the creature as it went past their ship, and they were able to kind of gauge the size of the creature because they knew how long their ship was.
Yes.
And then they could work it out from there. So.
And do you don't find these anomalies, I guess, is the best term I could come up with, as being totally unbelievable. You probably buy, I kind of buy into some of these things.
Well, what a lot of people don't realize is that the mountain gorilla was only officially acknowledged to exist just a little more than a century ago. You know, the giant panda that everybody sees in zoos today wasn't even classified till 1924. You know, 1924, there are people alive today who were alive before people knew what pandas were.
I'm not quite that old, folks.
So, you know, there's a lot of places in the world where we think we've traveled and we know everything that's going on in, under the oceans, in the jungles, but there are new animals being found every year. Granted, not the size of elephants or anything like that, but new types of deer are being found, you know, smaller animals. So the idea that a clever, a more intelligent, larger animal would be able to hide from us really isn't that difficult to explain.
Have you investigated any of these things personally recently?
Yeah, I've done a lot of research just recently to the Chupacabra in Puerto Rico. I've been on several expeditions out there looking for this creature.
Do you find any?
Well, a lot of witness testimony and a lot of ranchers who's...
What do you make of that? This whole thing, this whole legend?
Well, I think as far as the Chupacabra is concerned, I mean, it looks weird. It's described as having a monkey-like body, glowing eyes, wings in some cases, claws and talons and fangs. And it looks something like a gargoyle almost. And the important thing is that a lot of reports have been made by ranchers. A lot of veterinarians have carried out investigations. Police officers have reported seeing things. So there's no doubt in my mind that some sort of creature lives on Puerto Rico and it is killing the livestock. Now, what it is, we still don't know. Some people think it's alien. Some people think it's a creature that science hasn't classified yet. So we're still looking for that answer, I think. So.
Any strange creature? I guess actually some of these creatures have been spotted in South Texas.
Yeah, I mean, there have been reports of creatures in South Texas and into New Mexico that look like large hairless dogs with ratty tails and kind of vicious looking. And that's actually what they are. DNA testing has been done on them, and they are hairless coyotes or dogs.
So they look just like what they look like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But they've been given the name of the Texas Chupacabra by the media, and now everybody thinks they're the same creature on Puerto Rico, but they're not. It's just some
it's
the names.
Totally, yeah, totally different, but the same name.
The same name, yeah.
What turned you on? We talked about Hollywood. You like monster movies?
Yeah, I think there's been some good ones, some bad ones, and some terrible ones. I think there's been some good werewolf ones. American Werewolf in London, I like that one. Mimic was a good one about giant insects under the New York subway system. I like that.
You find anything in real life like that?
Well, you know,
how big do insects get?
Well, in the film, they're like 6 feet tall.
I mean, we hear about the Mothman.
Well, that's right. I mean, Mothman. Maybe some people wonder if Mothman could be, you know, some sort of giant insect. I don't personally think that, but the idea that there could be large winged creatures around the world, there's a lot of belief in that. Like the Native American Indians talk about the Thunderbirds. You have Mothman, obviously. Down on the Texas-Mexico border, we even get a lot of reports of creatures that sound just like pterodactyls. So there's a whole history and legends all around the world of large winged creatures that kind of, in some respects, have man-like qualities, but also bird-like. And obviously the most famous one is the Mothman of John Keel's book and the film The Mothman Prophecies. So, you know, but again, there's some of these stories that sound physical, some are sort of paranormal and supernatural.
So are you basically, you know, kind of centering on this for the time being?
Well, no, not really. I've got a book out.
I didn't figure you'd be focusing.
I've got a book out right now called Science Fiction Secrets, which is
all
about...
Ah, that sounds interesting. I like that title. Tell me about it.
Well, it's all about the way in which the government has used the science fiction world. For example, there are rumors that the government gave assistance to Steven Spielberg on his film Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So that's what the book's about, how the government has used the UFO subject, sorry, the science fiction subject, to acclimatize people to the idea that UFOs exist. Then in December, I've got another book out on the whole history of the contactee movement from the 40s to the present day.
And that'll be. Do you have a title for that book?
It's called Contactees.
Okay,
easy to remember.
By Nick Redfern. Looking forward to being in your bookstore starting in December.
December.
Just
yeah.
in time for Christmas.
Just in time for Christmas.
Make contact with Santa Claus.
Exactly.
What do you make of the Contactees stories?
Well, you know, a lot of people dismiss them. They think they're just ridiculous. But I think a lot of the contactees had genuine experiences with something. Now, whether it was literal extraterrestrials or some sort of phenomenon that wanted to get a message across about we need to live together in peace and harmony, some people who I've interviewed for the book think there could be like an intelligence on the Earth that approached these people in the form of guise of aliens because it was concerned about our warlike ways. But I think a lot of the contactees had real experiences with some sort of intelligent being.
Yeah, I don't think they can all be creative writers.
No. Something was going on and something was interacting with them. There's no doubt about that.
And it's hard to tell exactly what it is. Of course, I'm in the ET terrestrial business, extraterrestrial business, but it could be, you know, these stories have been going on for centuries, demons, angels, whatever.
They come in different guises. You know, in the 50s, it was long-haired aliens. We don't really see much of them today.
And now No, we don't. I wonder what happened to those
guys. They turned into the little gray guys.
Yeah.
People now see them. You know, it actually could be the same phenomenon, changing its appearance to suit the people of the times.
Well, you're from the UK. That place, and especially Ireland, and all it's full of all those stories about all those little
fairies,
creatures,
goblins.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, some people have said you can draw parallels, you know, between sightings of goblins in, say, the 1500s and the Greys today. You know, people talk about the goblins coming into the bedroom in the middle of the night, or people being abducted by fairies, which, in some respects, are stories are very similar to the abductee tales
of today.
Yeah,
I did a show recently on gins, and it's similar stuff.
You know, people wake up in the middle of the night paralyzed. You have stories like that going back thousands of years, and then it was like incubus and succubus stories. Today, it's people from Zeta Reticuli stealing our DNA, but it could be the same phenomenon.
And we don't know where they came from.
No, they may be.
Yeah, it may be any of the.
It could be any, or it could be all of them. Who knows?
Yeah, I think it's probably more likely to be something like that, all of the above.
Yeah, I think.
Bit of here, a little bit of there.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency with UFOs particularly for people to think it's alien and that's all it is. But there could be four or five explanations for the whole UFO mystery.
And one thing's for sure, people are seeing a lot of things. Now, a lot of that may be because it gets a lot of legitimate publicity these days.
Yeah.
And I was talking to the marketing director up at the lodge, and he said, well, I've been looking for one. I finally somehow found one, but it turned out to be a balloon. The point is that people in everyday life now are interested in the subjects because the popular media has saturated.
Well, I think also what happens is the people have begun to realize that they're not going to be ridiculed as much as they were maybe 20 years ago. And I think that's encouraging some people to come forward more with their story, which is a good thing, of course.
Yes, of course it is. Mm-hmm. Well, how do you write all these books and travel all the time? You're a pretty nomad person.
Well, I mean, I work full-time doing this, writing, so it's not like I have to put off a 9-to-5 job. I can get up in the morning at 8 and crank out, you know, till 5 o'clock
at night. When do you write? Daytime or night?
No, date. I usually try and stick to 8 till 5, and then if I'm at a conference...
You make it like a job.
Make it like a job, and then if I'm at a conference, I'll do that on a weekend. So.
And it makes sense, because what you write is pretty close to journalism, you know. It'd be a journalistic endeavor, and so you... It's like in my business, most of us have a routine.
Yeah, I just,
you get up and go to work, and you do your job, and you come home.
Now, a lot of authors, they like to work at night.
Yeah.
A lot of people I know, they like to sort of, you know, crank it out from 8 at night till 4 in the morning. I prefer to do normal.
Well, I end up doing a lot of night work, but really you're more creative, I think, early in the morning.
Well, I think it depends on the person, you know. I think everybody's a little bit different in terms of that. And whatever works for you is best to do that.
And as soon as you figure it out.
Yeah, when you figure it out.
And evidently you figured it out. You've turned out a few books.
Yeah, I try and do about one a year if I can, something like that. So.
And have you ever thought about doing some, well, the contactee's pretty close to a UFO subject.
Yeah, I mean, anything that's sort of a little bit unusual and where there's a mystery to be solved, you know, I like to look into it. So I don't consciously think, oh, I'm going to do a Bigfoot or a contactee book. If something comes along that I think is interesting and I feel that there's a story worth pursuing, then, you know, if I can, I'll do that.
Cryptozoology, you deal with a known or unknown substance, yeah. But it's probably an animal.
Mm-hmm.
So the only fear you'd have is that the animal might eat you or something.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, I do a lot of expeditions looking for these creatures because I think that's the only way we're going to solve it is to go out there and look for them. But as far as Bigfoot's concerned, other than one or two legends and friend of a friend tales, there really aren't any stories.
No, they don't seem to be dangerous at all.
Of people being attacked and eaten or anything like that. Now, there are a few reports where people got a sense that the Bigfoot didn't want them in the area, and almost like a telepathic message. But it wasn't hostile in terms of them being attacked. It was go away.
Well, you'd be surprised they wouldn't. That they'd be. They should be more hostile. I mean, you know, people are running around trying to shoot them all
the
time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if I was a Bigfoot,
if I was a Bigfoot, right, I might want to take the guy out before he did me.
But you know, I think again, this shows that maybe Bigfoot's more of an intelligent creature than we give it credit for. People think it's just a large, dumb ape. It may be sort of very evolved, highly evolved, and understands and appreciates the importance of life and existence, maybe.
Any other creatures get your attention?
Well, one of the strangest things is that we get a lot of Bigfoot reports in Britain. Now, there's no way Bigfoot could really live in Britain. Because of the size of the country, or the lack of size. And I think a lot of the British reports are paranormal, some sort of paranormal creature that looks like the American.
Kind of like the Jersey Devil or something.
Yeah, something that's, just, you know, it's one of these
comes out of there. And
yeah.
What do you think about, I guess it's possible that things could materialize and then go away?
Yeah, I mean, people talk about, for example, following Bigfoot tracks that suddenly come to an end as if it's vanished into thin air. And that's what leads some people to think they're from different dimensions and or different realms of existence, that that's how they're so elusive to us, that we can't catch them because they can zip in and out of our reality.
Okay, now your book that you have out right now is?
Science Fiction Secrets, which is published by Anomalous Books.
And in December you'll have?
Contactees, published by New Page Books.
And you can get those at your local bookstore or go to any of the websites. And we have links to Nick Redfern's books as well on our website. Nick, it's always a pleasure to see you.
All right, thanks, Jerry.
You're going to Albuquerque. Is that where you're hanging out now, or are you going on back to Dallas?
I'll go back to Dallas tomorrow, but just going back to Albuquerque tonight to get a hotel for an easy drive tomorrow to the airport.
Yeah, we're going to stop someplace. I have no idea where.
Yeah, same as me.
Yeah. Okay, well, we may choose the same place. Thanks very much, Nick Redfern.
Thanks,
this is Jerry Pippin when we're at Angel Fire.